You and I back together again, winding up a busy week, Friday, January 13th, Friday the 13th, 2023 on Connecticut Today. Closed out the week chatting with Connecticut Inside Investigator reporter Tricia Ennis about the state's high electric rates and further possible regulation. We heard from Professor Michael Rechtenwald, a PhD and author of The Great Reset and The Struggle for Liberty, Unraveling the Global Agenda. And I also had some thoughts, some humorous ones, on the current document controversy surrounding the Biden White House. How many of you folks, Eversource customers in particular, but even UI customers, say, why is my power always so expensive? We don't live in Alaska. We're not living in the high or low desert here. We have four seasons. Okay, everything costs more, but this is ridiculous. Connecticut, depending upon the year, the highest in the country, the top five, the top three. Not an easy question. Our next guest here to chat about this is an Emmy and AP award-winning journalist spending more than a decade working in the digital and broadcast media. She's covered everything from government corruption to science and space to entertainment. Right now, writing for the Inside Investigators section of the Yankee Institute, InsideInvestigator.org is the site. We have folks on from there all the time. Tricia Ennis joins us. Hey, Tricia, good afternoon. It's Paul at WICC. How are you?
Hey, Paul, I'm doing really well. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay.
And I'm here writing for Connecticut Inside Investigator.
Excellent. So let me ask you the $64 million question. Why the hell of our electric bills so high? I know we only have 20 minutes, but I hear that so often from my callers, Tricia. They can't figure it out. You've written a couple of pieces on this. So is there a simple answer to this or not?
You know what, Paul? I think if I'm able to give you a real simple answer, someone should give me $64 million. This is a complicated, complex, ongoing problem, not just here in Connecticut, but in the region, in the New England area, and across the country. You know, we've constantly got these issues of power bills, of energy bills, and you know, as we recently saw in a report that compiled information from the federal government, Connecticut ranks very, very high in the country for those energy costs.
Okay, so Tricia, and I've tried to understand this over the years. Now, I'm one of the fortunate people. I live in a town. I live in Wallingford. We have our own grid there. We don't we don't buy power from the new plant or whatever. So our rates are lowest. But from what I have been able to glean from people, we have what, the generation costs, the transmission costs, and then a whole bunch of extra fees mixed in, right? Is that part of the problem?
Yes, that's definitely part of the problem. You know, what's interesting is that those municipal utilities in places like Wallingford are able to provide power at a lower cost. And that's actually one of the things that members of the legislature are trying to understand. You know, why are Eversource or United Illuminating customers paying so much more for energy? Shouldn't these larger companies be able to buy power or buy the resources to generate that power, you know, more efficiently? They have, you know, bigger bargaining power. We don't know the answer to that. But yes, in most parts of the state, especially those who are Eversource customers, you see these much larger bills. And that's because, in part, because those bills are made up of different things, right? You have your supply rate, which is the amount of money you're paying to bring the power, bring those resources in to generate that power. And then you have your delivery rate, which includes both the, you know, the infrastructure to get power from those power plants to your home, but it also includes passed on fees, you know, things that the company is paying for, infrastructure upgrades, you know, charitable donations, various things that they are paying for that they are then passing on to the consumer.
Also, Tricia, there is the dynamic of this is, you know, Eversource and UI. These are for-profit companies. You know, they have shareholders and they have a fiduciary responsibility to at least return something to the shareholders, or people cash out their shares. They're battling that, too, aren't they?
They absolutely are. And this is one of those problems that is not just local. You know, it's not just a Connecticut problem. It's not just a New England problem. These are for-profit energy utilities across the country that are, you know, they are owned, they're shareholder-owned. They are public companies that need to turn a profit for their investors. So, you know, they're not just paying for the infrastructure upgrades. They are also passing on a small amount of money that accounts for their profit margin.
And a whole bunch of folks in Greenwich, Bridgeport, New Haven, Hartford, just about everywhere in the state, save for a few municipalities, open up their electric bills. Good times and bad, war, non-war, and saying, geez, why is this so expensive? Connecticut annually or monthly, whatever way you want to look at it, at least in the top five, if not the two or three of domestic energy costs. Tricia Ennis, she's with us for a few more minutes, investigative reporter. Check out her pieces, report the Connecticut electric rates are the highest in the continental U.S., and Lamont outlining long-term plans to curb energy costs. Check her out, Inside Investigative. .org. Okay, Patricia, here's my grand idea. You buy out Eversource. How about that? Practical idea or not?
I don't know practical, but certainly an idea. Like you mentioned before the break, you know, Long Island, New York State did this for Long Island, mm-hmm. and it lowered those energy costs by, I think, about 20%. Making it so that the power generation is not, you know, beholden to shareholders, so they're not being forced to turn a profit, certainly would help customers, you know, paying lower bills.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you have a point there, absolutely.
Yeah, but short of that, which even would take years in the deliberation stage, I mean, what happens mm-hmm. here? And I know the governor, you know, Tricia, it seems that lawmakers mm-hmm. are sincere about this, but it sounds like their hands are tied and you get this program and that program and it ends up being a Band-Aid. And what about Pura in all this? And people say, oh, Pura sounds like or acts like a toothless tiger. What's that dynamic like?
I would say that even the folks at Pura would tell you that they don't have enough power in the state to really do anything, to do anything substantial with these power companies. Now, Pura basically operates like your superior court, right? The consumer advocates can come to them, and the utilities come to them as sort of two sides of this argument. They present their argument, and Pura can make a ruling. But they don't have control over these supply rates, which is what we're seeing go up right now, is the supply rates for energy.
So has
they can, however, tell. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was going to say, so and forgive me because I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but in the recent past, has Pura just ever said, no, you can't do this, we will not, no, you can't have any increases this time, this is ridiculous, or is it virtually impossible for them to do that?
I think it's much more difficult for them to do that than they would like. I also don't have the figures in front of me right now. I believe they have in the past, you know, denied certain portions of those delivery fees or certain things that Eversource says they want to collect or they want to raise. But if, for example, in this supply rate case, I don't know that they have the ability to make any decisions. I was recently actually talking to the chairman of Pura, Marissa Gillett, and she, you know, she expressed that frustration that she doesn't feel like Pura has as much regulatory authority as she would like for them to have. And one of those things that she wants to be able to do is provide more transparency to customers over exactly what they are paying for in those delivery fees.
I think there was, over the past week or so, with the General Assembly session starting mm-hmm. again, Tricia, I think there was somebody floated the idea, well, why don't we let lawmakers in the General Assembly have a vote or a final say on this and put this out front? Nice idea, but I don't see members of the General Assembly chomping at the bit to do that, if you know what I mean.
Certainly, and I don't know that they could easily come to an agreement over how much of a say that they should have or over, you know, how easily they would be able to make those votes. They only have, you know, partial sessions every year, so they only have a few months to decide on, you know, every big decision they need to make for the state, and adding another thing to that slate, you know, how easily are they going to be able to do that?
So, Tricia, finally, I guess it's just make your home or your business more energy efficient. I mean, what else is there, right, when you come right down to it?
That is absolutely what I have been told by experts in both energy efficiency and in energy policy, economic policy related to energy, is that efficiency is the watchword. If you can, you know, cut down on the amount of wasted energy you have in your home, you cut down on the amount you need to pay for energy, and you also are going to be cutting down on the amount of energy that needs to be generated, which means that, you know, those supply rates can come down as well for everyone across the board.
All right, check out these articles by Tricia Ennis at the InsideInvestigator.org website. Once again, InsideInvestigator.org, a branch of the Yankee Institute. Tricia Ennis reporting on energy issues. Tricia, thanks. You have the number now, so don't hesitate, and we'll talk to you down the road. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. There you go. All right, folks. Well, as Tricia said, and she covers this beat, it's tough. You know, the no, and yeah, see, the buyout of New York State, they bought out the Long Island Lighting Company, LILCO. And I remember years ago, this was a huge controversy. They got it pushed through. It took billions of dollars. It was a regulatory mess, but folks on Long Island, they say now we're paying about 20% less for electricity because there's no need to return profits again. So that's kind of the downside of the, you know, the second edge of the double-edged sword of you know, of public utilities being publicly owned. Yeah, there's a great, it's easy to get working capital in there, but you know, you also have to generate something so somebody keeps their savings, their shares, their retirement fee, they keep it in there. Our next guest is an author of many books, the author of 12 books. His new one out there is prime for your thought. It's called The Great Reset and the Struggle for Liberty, Unraveling the Global Agenda. And we welcome to WICC Dr. Michael Rechtenwall, Professor Rechtenwall, PhD, formerly Professor of Liberal Studies and Global Studies at NYU. His website, Michael Rechtenwall, Rechtenwald, MichaelRechtenwald.com. Dr. Rechtenwall, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I'm great, Paul. How are you?
Yes, good. Thank you. Sorry for that choppy intro. Now you know why I went to get new glasses yesterday, and they should be here in a week. So
okay.
Everything should be good. The name of the book is provocative. And do you get, Dr. Rechtenwald, anybody reading maybe the title of the book or, oh, The Global Agenda, you're one of those, here we go again. Explain what the book is about and maybe how you fend off some of these people who maybe, you know, call you, oh, it's another conspiracy nut. What do we have going on here?
Well, this is a conspiracy fact, and really not a conspiracy at all, actually. It's an open, avowed plan to bring about a change in the world economy. This has been announced, and it's stated over and over by the World Economic Forum, to bring about a new world economic order and to change our way of life, our habits of consumption, our mobility, even our rights are being impacted by this. And so the book details the economic system that this would set up, and then it goes into the deep history of the World Economic Forum, where it came from, how it evolved, et cetera. Then I go into the population ethics that they have, the World Economic Forum and some of its globalist partners have been spouting for decades. And then I go into the technologies that they are aiming to use, in effect, to surveil and control the population. I also take on the climate change science directly, because that's the main pretext for all of this.
Is this, Professor Rechtenwald, rooted or seeded in any way out of just a general jealousy of, no matter what shape the world is in, America's resilience, the resilience of our people and our economic power? Is that part of it?
Yes, I mean, they definitely want to reset. They see the developed world and the United States being the primary target thereof, as our population represents a scourge on the planet because we overconsume and over-reproduce and basically drive cars around and all this. This all has to be reset, according to these globalist leaders. like Klaus Schwab at the World Economic Forum and the United Nations, who has been touting this for some time. Really, the Great Reset amounts to the World Economic Forum's efforts to bring about the Sustainable Development Goals of the UN's 2030 agenda. So all of this is on the table. There's nothing secretive here.
Name of the book, The Great Reset and the Struggle for Liberty, Unraveling the Global Agenda. The author joining us for a bit more time here, Professor Michael Rechtenwald, a PhD, former professor of liberal studies and global studies at NYU. Dr. Rechtenwald, I see obviously your background includes NYU. Not exactly now I had relatives that went to NYU years ago. It's a lot different now than it was back then, and I'm sure you have anecdotes and stories and experiences, as I talk to a lot of other college professors around the country at varying universities, that the young mind, Dr. Rechtenwald, is really kind of being manipulated by some of these universities and professors to kind of believe in this stuff that you're warning us about in your book.
Oh, absolutely. So these schools, largely, most of academia and most departments within the universities are nothing but indoctrination camps at this juncture. So they're effectively indoctrinating students into particular worldviews. And that worldview is largely anti-capitalist, if not outright avowed socialist, then very socialist friendly. And in fact, they're training, I trained students in global studies to be part of this whole system, to be part of this globalist agenda that I'm referring to. So I know it intimately.
What kind of a foothold, Professor, do the forces that want to do this, to want to suck the influence and money out of the U.S., what kind of foothold do they have in Congress right now?
They have a very substantial foothold in Congress and also in the executive branch. After all, Joe Biden the Politburo, as I like to call them, have signed into law, 12 executive orders aimed at climate change mitigation, and then the so-called Inflation Reduction Act devoted $287 billion to climate change mitigation. And so there's a great contingent, and many of these congresspersons and senators have ties to the World Economic Forum, but more importantly, the executive branch. You have John Kerry. He's going to the World Economic Forum's meeting again this next week, next Monday. He'll be there. So, very much the administration here is very much signed on to this agenda.
What do you say to the folks, Dr. Rechtenwald, and our guest is Professor Michael Rechtenwald, PhD, former professor of liberal studies and global studies at NYU. What do you say to the people that obviously you've encountered, I would think, in your speaking engagements, your writing, and your academia, who say, Professor, you have your opinion, we have ours, and we kind of think this is a good idea. America still cranks out more money than any other nation. The heck with a country that buys all these SUVs and flies, how dare they, wherever they want. There's an obligation for America to do better by the world. What do you say to all that?
Well, I think it's bunk. When they give me that how dare you Greta Thunberg line, I start to suggest that, in fact, what they're ushering and how dare they, because what they would do would to destroy the free market and individual liberty in the process, and they want to bring about what really essentially amounts to a monopoly system whereby you have these preferred producers getting all of the capital and the rest being starved of capital. They will create a two-tiered system with the oligarchs on top with the state and kind of actually existing socialism on the ground for everybody else. And so they're the tyrants, they're the totalitarians, and their foot soldiers are also part of the regime. I would tell them that they are the ones that are imposing on us a most outrageous plan that would, in fact, be detrimental to themselves.
And you know what I think upsets them too, Professor Rechtenwald, is that here is America, and Lord knows we do some things not really well. We do a lot of things well, but we put all our scars, our misgivings out there for everyone to see, yet there are millions of people who would flock here if given a second's notice at the drop of a hat. People come here to live the American dream, and I'm sorry to phrase it this way, but you have a lot of these backwards countries, Professor, who have received billions and hundreds of billions of dollars of aid over decades, much of it from us, and they still can't get it right, and that's what I think fuels a lot of this.
Yes, that's right. There's a lot of antipathy for the United States, both, largely within the country. There's a lot of self-hatred, and that's a pathetic position to take. Largely, they don't recognize that the rights that they enjoy, even the rights to criticize the country, are endowed to them through the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. So they're living a contradiction in a sense, because they're actually promoting the opposite of what we have and what gives them the right to even complain. This is really a tragic scenario. The United States represents the last impediment to this global agenda, because we have a constitution, we have a constitutional republic, we have a Bill of Rights, and we have a real strong spirit of independence here, which I think will overcome this agenda in the long run.
And once again, the name of the book, The Great Reset and the Struggle for Liberty, Unraveling the Global Agenda. Pick it up Amazon, wherever, or go to the website, michaelrechtenwald.com. We thank Professor Michael Rechtenwald, PhD, former professor of liberal studies and global studies at NYU. Professor, thank you so much. It's been fascinating, and we'll chat down the road. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Paul. Nice talking to you.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Once again, that is Dr. Professor Michael Rechtenwald, former professor of liberal studies and global studies at NYU. How about that? And here's a guy who says he taught some of those globalist theories one time at NYU. Not quite a right-wing school, although I had a relative who went to NYU and loved it years and years ago. Oh, man, is her head on a swivel today, huh? Karine Jean-Pierre. Sitting here in the studio prepping for the show today, watching the White House spokesperson, Karine Jean-Pierre, taking questions. Oh, a little testy now, Ms. Karine. Hey, how are you? Yes, shoes on the other foot. Now, look. I don't know what's in these Biden top secret or secret documents or classified documents, whatever. That's way above my pay grade. And they probably have something to do with the military, something to do with foreign powers. What's the CIA doing? What's the FBI doing? Whatever. Secret Service, NSA, whatever. That's all. That's another chapter here. I really couldn't care less. Again, that's stuff that's way above my pay grade. I mean, way up there. I'm in the basement or on the first floor here, yapping my gums every Monday through Friday from 2 to 6. But these people actually have, uber responsibility for the country. But, man, isn't this hysterical? And again, I know it's a serious thing. And it was serious when Mr. Trump did it, too. I think if you listen to this show, and you should, every Monday through Friday from 2 to 6, tell your friends, your relatives, even the people you can't freaking stand. Tell them about the show. But I think you know that I've tried to be pretty consistent about this, right? When the FBI was dispatched to Mar-a-Lago, and when was that? The first week of August, I think is what it was, August 7th or August 8th, something like that. I said, well, okay. If they're that desperate to get these back and they feel that the Trump legal people were stonewalling, all right, whatever. In the grand scheme of things, it's a big show and life goes on. Is he going to end up in jail at this point? Who cares? Right off into the sunset, Mr. Trump, I don't care. But, man, how and when I say how great, I'm not saying it in a sense of, oh, this is great because they're going to get Biden, because they're not. I shouldn't say not. the likelihood that, and I know there are conservatives and Republicans now, oh, they're licking their chops at this Biden thing. Here he goes, well, you don't know what's in there. And I mean, come on. They're talking about 10 documents, a dozen documents. Now, it doesn't mean that it's right. I understand that. So you don't have to call me and say, well, Paul, two wrongs don't make a right. I agree with you. My mom told me that, you know, 50-something years ago when I was first tuning in to the galactic environment around me. But it's kind of interesting now how my business, the reportage, the editorial business, it's kind of interesting, isn't it, how my business is handling all this, right? And the spinorama coming from the other side. Oh, this is great. So I love this. Oh my God. See, in the end, I don't think this is a big deal. I think any effort here, well, you've got to impeach Biden. Stop. Don't waste your time with that. Because it's never going to go anywhere because the Senate's not going to convict him. We've seen and heard this song before, as Mr. Sinatra used to say over all those years. So, you know, it's not going to go anywhere. But the glee, maybe it's not glee, but the enjoyment I'm seeing here is the spinorama coming from the White House and from CNN and from MSNBC. And I'm watching MSNBC now, of course, with the volume down here in the studio. And they've been all over this. And the narrative is, and I don't blame him for this narrative. What the hell else are you going to say? Well, this was not as severe as Mr. Trump. It is a number of fewer documents, and he didn't do this intentionally, whatever, but it still happened. And the out-and-out joy, the laughing. I was here with another staff member here at the station, and we were looking up and watching Karine Jean-Pierre. Her head was spinning, her eyeballs rolling back in her head as the press corps was hammering her rhetorically, pretty much saying, hey, and here's the part. Now, Merrick Garland, good for you. You see where Merrick Garland probably needed a couple of shots at Briofsky when he found out about this. So what did he do? He quickly, He hired a special prosecutor, too, just the way that there's a special prosecutor going after the Trump side of this thing. So he was pretty smart here. Like, okay, I'm not going to wait on this. He probably called his assistant, and one of his assistant attorneys general said, hey, give me a name. I need a name here. Give me somebody by lunchtime or by the afternoon who you know can look into this without it turning into a five-car pileup somewhere. Just give me somebody. So he appointed, I think, somebody. Did he name a name? But whatever. He got his rear end out of that situation. Here. But here's the overriding factor. And what do you think about this? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. And I know we like to play it a little bit lighter on Fridays after we've gone through a week that's usually replete with lousy news. But I got to tell you something. This to me is manna from heaven. This is I'm not angry about this. I'm just laughing. This is hysterical. Because part of the narrative is, oh, it's not like Trump. It's not like Trump. And you know who's having a good chuckle over this? Donald John Trump. He has got to be laughing over this. He has to be. And it's funny that even when he did nothing about this, he's still driving the news cycle. And it's hysterical because there's some people in my business that, you know, they despise Trump, but man, they keep him in the news cycle. But here's the whole thing that's real. What's the point behind the story, Paul? Well, it's pretty simple. What happened was, and it's distilled down in these two paragraphs. After learning that President Biden's attorneys found top secret documents stashed in his unsecured office at a D.C. think tank 6 days before the midterms, Republican lawmakers are asking why it took more than 2 months for the public to learn about the discrepancies. That's the point. Why did they wait till after the midterms and even wait until CBS mentioned it earlier in the week? So there's two levels of the story here. One level is, okay, Biden had the documents, and then I guess there's another box or stash of them in the Biden garage. They found them in the garage. He said they were behind my Corvette. He's a car guy, Joe. His father used to sell cars, so he's always loved cars. Joe's got a vintage Corvette. Nice set of wheels, right? But I guess these classified documents were in a box behind his vintage Corvette. Don't you keep stuff in your box behind your vintage Corvette? Now, the White House says Mr. Biden's attorneys wasted no time notifying the National Archives and Record Administration. They found 10 documents with classified markings mixed in with Biden family papers at the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement, a fact not made public until CBS News reported on it Monday night. And now we find that there are documents, they found in a box behind his car in his garage. Were they next to the lawnmower, too? Does he have a lawnmower in there? Maybe a weed whacker? Does our president? Sorry. Does it? Come on, you know what you have in your, you know what your dad or mom had in the garage there? Weed whacker? Hand trimmer? Man, if you were Italian, you had to have one of those hand trimmers. You know the ones I'm talking about? The long blades and the squeeze handle there? Because, man, when my father was done with that lawn, oh, the edge of the lawn, he hated his weed whacker. He had to get down on his knees. It's an Italian thing. The lawn's got to look like freaking AstroTurf. But, Dad, what are you doing? Never mind. That was my father's cue for me to shut up. Never mind. So I wonder if Joe has that in the garage. What do you think? I just think this is hysterical. I'm having a great laugh over this. You know, is this going to cause World War III? No. Lord knows those documents were probably there by accident. Though, of course, you never know, though. Was Hunter floating around? Was he doing the crack pipe that day? I don't know. Traffic. I'm sorry. It's a Friday. Give me a break.